Welcome to this Depth Dispatch podcast. We'll be discussing Trade and Environment Review Report 2021, Trade and Environment for Developing Countries. My name is Eugene Jannigan. I'm a trade policy analyst, passionate in regional integration, climate change, and I work for Action Green for Trade. With me, I have Shengi Ndovu and John Peter Mulemba. Over to you, Shengi Ndovu.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much, Eugene. I'm also excited to join these conversations on the intersection of climate change and trade. My name is Jengisiwe Ndlovu. You can call me Jengi. Currently, I'm working on an assignment on trade facilitation with the SADC Secretariat. This conversation to me is very important to unpack how climate change will impact trade or how trade will be impacted by climate change. Thank you very much.
Thank you. John.
I'm very excited as well to be joining this podcast. My name is John Kasita Semulema. I am a country engagement specialist with the NDC Partnership. The NDC Partnership is an institution that brings together several developing countries and developed countries, as well as development agencies, to work towards achieving the goals of the International Climate Agreement, which you could also call the Paris Agreement. And I think the intersectionality between trade and climate change is a matter of good discussion because both sides do influence each other in one way or another. So I'm really excited that we're having this podcast and have the opportunity to show how trade in itself has been a major cause of climate change, but then how climate change itself is going to impact trade moving forward. So I'm really excited to be here.
Thank you so much. I'll do some summary of the report. So this is a report made by ANCTAD, you know, United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, you know, and the study prepared by Robert Hamway. This podcast is organized by Depth Dispatch. I will just begin with a quote by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who says that governments everywhere must reassess their energy policies. If not, the world would be uninhabitable. I just paraphrase that. John, regards to that quote, what comes to your mind?
I think that's a strong statement that is made there. And I think that's a call for action that the Secretary General was trying to place at that point in time. So some people see it as an issue that has to be fought tooth and nail because it's going to be a terminal end to humanity. Some others think it's just something made up and are taking it lightly. But I feel like the statement by the Secretary General there is an immediate call for action because we speak of a world that's not going to be habitable, and that's scary.
Thank you so much. I want to ask Shengi Ndovu. I hope I'm pronouncing the name correctly. What are some of the physical, economic, environmental, and social impacts of climate change on developing countries?
Thank you, Eugene. The statement by the UN Secretary General that you spoke about actually echoes a lot in developing countries. I mean, suggesting that the world at some point will become inhabitable if we don't take heed of the effects of climate change. I'm actually joining this conversation from Zimbabwe. And fresh on our memories is Cyclone Idai, which overnight destroyed people's lives. A lot of human lives were lost during this cyclone. The subsequent droughts that they followed has been accompanied by food shortages and long-term food insecurity. So the impact is huge. And when we're talking about maybe coastal places, we look at Southern Africa, the environment, the fauna there, wildlife, your fisheries, everything is just being impacted by climate change. So indeed, the impacts are enormous for us all to see. Even the Doubting Thomases, I think we are all now unanimous that indeed there is this huge phenomenon that is upon us as developing countries.
Thank you very much, Sengi. To John, you've been engaged in the country level. And I want to know, how can Africa, you know, enhance their resilience on climate change?
When we speak about agriculture, fisheries, and tourism, we are speaking about sectors that are more or less the backbone of several economies within the African continent. for a matter of context, at least 68% on average in all African countries is the population of people that are engaged in agriculture as a livelihood. So that's really huge. It can't be taken for granted. On the other hand, if this 68% of the people that are engaged in agriculture are only able to contribute about 28% of the GDP. So agriculture employs really so many people in Africa that in terms of GDP contribution is averagely just about 28. What that means is that with climate change coming to impact agriculture further, we are going to see a further decline of this already not so well performing GDP contribution. Because, I mean, if you have 68% of your people engaged in an area, you would think you would also have your highest GDP coming from there, but it already shows that that's not the case. And with climate change impacts, with extended droughts, with heat waves bringing with it new pests and crop diseases, with changing weather patterns that are going to disrupt rainfalls, and we as Africa having a rainfall-based agriculture system, we are seeing that we are going to have this GDP contribution affected grossly. What this means is we need to revise how we are seeing agriculture as a continent. It's either that we adapt to the changes by moving out of agriculture to engage in other sectors that are much more productive today, or by embracing the service sector as an alternative. So here, I'm not just talking about us trying to adapt the agriculture system, introducing drought-resistant crops and stuff like that, but trying to move away from it and going into other sectors that are much more profitable. So when you think about, say, IT and banking and insurance, these are service sectors that employ so small a number of people in Africa today, but are contributing a huge amount in terms of GDP. And there's not a reason why we shouldn't be adapting our systems by trying to move more into these sectors. It also means when these sectors are developed, they can, in the long run, support the agriculture sector itself. Say, for instance, if you're having a very well-developed IT sector or banking sector, you're probably going to have enough domestic mobilization of finance to go into agricultural production and adaptation in the agriculture system. So first you move away into something more productive, get money from it, inject the money back into the agriculture that's not well performing to try and safeguard it. Yeah, not a very easy way to think about it, but definitely one way we need to consider as a continent.
Wow, thank you very much, John. That was a very nice explanation, especially with some sectors, you know, banking, insurance, coming in to support agriculture. Now to Shengi, for the culture as the backbone of most of the African countries, how do we move forward in terms of how do we diversify so that we reduce the effects of climate change?
Agriculture is the backbone of African economies. But then with the reality of the threat of climate change, we do need to now think outside the box. And thinking outside the box is also going to be difficult because Africa is still developing. And with that position, it means that our options are very limited. And actually asking us as Africans to rethink our agricultural position is actually a tall order. But again, let me be the devil's advocate that we have realized, even without climate change, we have realized the need for diversification. And we're also speaking on the AFFTA. That has also realized that in order for Africa to actually overcome the pangs of poverty, they have to also think beyond agriculture. So it's not only from a trade point of view, but also from a climate change point of view. That may be the road leads to manufacturing. And when we're looking at manufacturing, how is that manufacturing going to be done? Obviously, with a focus on the environment, with a focus on sustainability, and with a focus also on measures that are not going to be promoting the worsening effects of climate change. Obviously, we cannot wish away agriculture, but we also look at revolutionized ways of engaging into agriculture. Maybe it comes also an opportunity for further research and development into moving away from the traditional crops, obviously guided by research, onto crops that will be resilient with the impact of climate change, obviously with also an eye on the environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Shenge. That was great, bringing in manufacturing, but again, being conscious of how it should contribute to climate change. I was now thinking about the link that, you know, with climate change and coronavirus. And I want to know how countries have managed this.
If I can come in there. There's a very interesting debate on how climate on its own has been able to lead to new, well, not new diseases per se, but to new ways of pathogen spreading and, of course, eventually development of new diseases. And I think it's a whole new research area of its own. How does climate change interact with health? There might definitely be a link as organisms are moving in ways they haven't moved before. And it's possible that they're also evolving in ways they haven't evolved before. And with that can definitely come new diseases. I do not want to necessarily say that the coronavirus was a result of such. But having said that, there was an observation also that as a result of the pandemic and the standstill that it brought, the reduction in greenhouse gases was enormous. So just over a space of 12 months when things were really on a standstill, flights were not as many as they were before, not so much cargo was moving with the ships, the reduction in greenhouse gases was so, so huge. And it could tell the story of how much movement in itself of goods and services has been a huge contributor of greenhouse gas emissions and consequently climate change. That said, it gives us an opportunity to think about as we come out of the corona pandemic and an economic decline due to the coronavirus, how do we couple our economic recovery with climate action? See, I mean, we've learned a couple of things. We've learned that you could sit here in Bonn and someone sits in Zimbabwe and someone sits in Nairobi and sits wherever and have a conversation without necessarily having to have a workshop in Harare. We've learned that as we build back an economy that we should couple rebuilding an economy with climate action. So building back green, a green recovery, if we can coin a word. So this green recovery means how can we be more sustainable in our trade? Where should the investments go? Should we go back to the sectors that were high emitters, or should we now divert funding to areas that will produce green jobs? So that's the way we can couple tackling economic recovery with climate action to strengthen our economies against the impacts of climate change.
I think John makes very interesting observations and comments. According to the report that was under discussion, we see the damaging effects of the carbon emissions, what it has done to the oceans. You'd realize, without being a scientist, that maybe in the circle of life, in the symbiotic relationship that we have on this planet, some functions cannot just be wiped away from the face of Earth without consequences on humankind. I am persuaded to think that with the escalation of the impact of climate change, this will manifest itself more broadly than it is right now. I would also caution that as we discuss this report going forward, I think such conversations as well, they must trickle down to the stakeholders, because as it is, the climate change or climate action, as it were, is a subject that is maybe for the few and limited to the few, to the academic world, and less to the grassroots. And that has always been the demise of interventions that are coming from top, because at times these things are not even taken seriously. And climate change has had serious challenges, because we see that the powers that be, the very people we look up to, they actually may be debating that this is something which is made up. What more of those people who are at grassroots level? So here I'm saying that when we have a platform like this by Development Dispatch, we need to involve the grassroots, even all the stakeholders in the private sector, because as the opening remarks actually revealed, that at a certain point, if we don't heed, if we don't adapt, this planet will be inhabitable.
Maybe as it comes through, just to reflect a bit on what you just said, Shengyi, indeed, you cannot treat climate change as a topic of the elite, because when you do, then you miss out the point. The truth is that the people that suffer the greatest impacts of climate change aren't even the elites. The question comes through on, aside from involving them in a conversation, how can they be empowered to impact the conversation? Because it's not enough to say, for instance, ask the people that are suffering the impacts of climate change. It should be that they are empowered enough to do something about the impacts that they suffer. And I think that's so far a missing link. Many of these communities aren't empowered enough anyway to contribute meaningfully to this discussion. Apart from being part of the statistics, they might have experiences that they've lived, but they might not have enough technical information to inform how things should be moving forward in terms of solutions. But I really agree with you. You shouldn't treat it with elitism, so to say.
True. I couldn't have said it any better, John. Agriculture is actually the first casualty. Right now, we are experiencing the effects of climate change. We're actually experiencing perennial drought. And what we are simply doing is studying rainfall patterns instead of maybe starting the adaptation now that is being discussed on the report. And by adaptation, I'm actually linking to the empowerment that John spoke about, empowerment of our grassroots people, that maybe is also the right time now that they start unlearning with our subsistence farmers. It's difficult to unlearn or maybe to actually try and separate them from planting the traditional crops, rearing the traditional livestock that they are used to. And so now maybe it's also the time to start creating the awareness at those levels, moving in a direction of empowering in such a practical manner that it will also deliver on their part. Because really experiencing a perennial drought is not one, because we're talking about food security here, and experiencing the health of livestock deplete in such fast ways because of the high temperatures. Not a joke. We also need to remember, as the report highlights, the impact on the human beings as well, because of the high temperatures, which obviously come with diseases. Although we are not a scientist, but it's common sense that once the temperatures are elevated, the human body cannot have that optimum productive capacity to be healthy. So the plans of action that actually should be now be forming a basis of the conversation with our grassroots. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Shengyi. That was wonderful. John, too, that was well said in terms of how we need to go down to the grassroots and all stakeholders to move on. Point one, are we in Catch 22? We know that developed countries are well known in terms of contributing to climate change. We, as developing countries, we need also to look at how do we develop, how do we move forward without really having a lot of these challenges in climate change. Because poor countries say, if we don't do this and that, we're not going to develop. How do we balance this issue? John, what do you think?
I did hint at some point on the need to shift our economy away from this agriculture-based economy and tap into what the countries that you referred to as developed actually are doing. So I just want to give you a picture. The average contribution to the GDP of the developed countries is about 70%. That contribution comes from the service sector. So over 70% of the GDP contribution of the major economies comes from the service sector. So it's not from agriculture or manufacturing or things like that that we've actually believed for a very long time. Hospitality, finance, insurance, telecom, IT, entertainment, banking, name it. These are the cash cows that are making the major economies lots of money, transport and the likes. And if we are saying as developing countries that we want to match up, then we have to learn one thing. Agriculture cannot take us there. That's the truth. And that's the truth that we need to unlearn today, like Shengyi also spoke about. There are things we need to unlearn today. I also gave you another statistic, which shows that although 68% on average of the entire African population is involved in agriculture directly or indirectly, agriculture as a whole only contributes not more than 23% of the GDP of Africa. So you see, so many people involved in something that gives back so little in terms of money and survival. So there is not so much need to keep doing things the same way. There's a need to think differently. There is a need to diversify our economies. There's no reason we cannot do this. It does not mean we ditch agriculture, but it means that we stop putting all our eyes and blinding ourselves to other possibilities and focusing on a sector that will not yield so much in the long run. We then shift our attention to the finance industry. Think about African countries. How many African countries actually can count up to, say, 15 traditional banks of their own that are local banks? You will count only a few countries in the African continent. All these banks will be foreign. How many telecoms are actually African-owned telecoms? When you think about it, you just count MTN and maybe some other 1, 2, 3, 4 other subsidiaries. All the other telecoms will be coming in from somewhere else. When you think about insurance companies that you see in your countries, where are they from? So all these things, these are industries that are getting lots of money and shipping it out of these countries and taking it back to the major economies that you admire so much. But if these were sectors that could be invested in locally, it would mean that we can generate lots of income to be able to even import food like these other countries do. These other countries are not net producers of food. They are importers of food, but they don't need to grow food because you are there to grow it. They focus on the other sectors that actually bring in the real money. And this is what needs to be done in the long run for Africa. We do not necessarily ditch the agriculture, but we don't think about it as the only thing. We need to look into the other modern sectors today, which are such huge cash cows, tap into those powers, get the money that we require to fund agriculture. And when you think about the money that we require, it's also a lot. So this same report, for instance, speaks about $140 to $300 billion required in annual costs for adaptation in developing countries. If we take the fact that the lion's share of developing countries is in Africa, we could say $100 billion per annum is required to adapt to impacts of climate change in Africa. Who is going to give us that money? No one. No one's going to give us that money. Adaptation is, you know, it doesn't generate back money. It's a grant-based thing. So no one is ready to sink $100 billion per annum. But then again, because of the need of this money, it's an opportunity for investment. The private sector could come in here. There's need for agriculture insurance as an investment in Africa. So many people would be willing to insure their produce. Why isn't this there? Why isn't it devolved? There's need for agriculture banks. Those that are up there mostly for the sector, they are devolved, they are banks, but they are mostly focusing on this sector. Why aren't they there? These type of banks are everywhere in the developed countries. So again, a shift in mindset to not focus on the things that we always knew, but to look out to what's possible and what new ways of doing things are there, and trying to jump on them and devote our energy to that, I think would move us a few steps ahead.
Thank you very much, John. That's well said. I want to come to Shenge, or rather to bring out the discussion in terms of how we mobilize our resources, because as John has mentioned, chances are we won't get this support. How do we mobilize our resources? Shenge, how do we mobilize funds?
Thank you, Eugene. Before I answer your question, allow me to comment a bit on what John has said. John has raised very interesting and pertinent points in his last presentation. It has always been difficult for Africa to actually penetrate export markets in developed countries. When we look at the services sector, we indeed have actually maybe gotten the gist. We are in the right trajectory. If we look at the ASFTA, it has identified the priority sectors, of which are the services sectors. We're looking at tourism, communication, transport, finance, and business services. And John's inputs are adequately cover on what can happen within these listed sectors. But then the problem now is that within Africa, in order for services to actually realize the fullest potential that is actually embedded in the services sector, is for it to actually be able to have what we call a mode of commercial presence, as it were. And that is a challenge on its own when you look at Africa, because there's no free movement of people. Even that protocol on its own is still not being taken as actively as it's supposed to be taken. So I agree totally with John that the services sector actually present a low-hanging fruit in order for Africa to adjust and adapt. Because in there, there are also these revenues, which now bring me to answer the question raised by Eugene. These sectors are actually going to enable us to unleash the revenues. And as far as the fund is concerned, we need, first of all, to go back to the drawing board and capacity building, education, and actually impress upon the private sector, impress upon the CSOs. We have a sort of a collective and an amplified voice in order for us to have the revenues that are so much required. Because if we are tempted again, maybe to look outside Africa to have those funds, because we'll be feeling justified, because we are saying, no, this problem was caused by our neighbors. So our neighbors should fund us. We know how it is when you are going to be relying on that. So the ball is in our court that we mobilize this 100 billion. And how, as countries mobilize that, we first of all have to start at the drawing board by sensitizing all the critical stakeholders about the effects of climate change. Once we are educated, we are also able to contribute intelligently to the debate. At the end of the day, there must be sustainability in whatever we recommend in mobilizing these revenues. The trajectory is set, and it has been actually been aided by the current AFCFTA, because it's actually all-encompassing, it's covering a lot of issues, and the fact that the agreement is linked to the SDGs, it means that when we're dealing with the climate change, it's going to be easier. I am saying, first and foremost, sensitization, education, and once we are educated on the climate change, then everyone is actually empowered to contribute meaningfully on how we're going to mobilize these resources. Thank you, Eugene.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That is well said. I totally agree with you when you even say that agriculture is king. We can't do without agriculture. I think that what African people need to do is to balance how they produce their food so that we produce the food that is sustainable, you know. And of course, we also know many parts of Africa, you know, those places are food insecure. So I think we can't leave out agriculture. There is still a window for us to develop agriculture. And at the same time, like John was saying, we also push about the service sector. Our country, like Kenya, we know we have a debt problem. We've really borrowed a lot of money, and we are continuing borrowing and really affecting our country. So and in some way, we cannot really even tackle issues of climate change. Those are put down somewhere down there, and it's not really a focus of our executive. So how do we mobilize funds and make everyone involved? I don't know what you guys think about that, especially the
chance
that we have.
Maybe to come in on that, I don't know if we really have to convince anyone. I think the impacts of climate change and how they're impacting our economies is, in my opinion, very obvious and evident. If you're in sub-Saharan Africa especially, and I don't think there's any more need to convince anybody. What I also think is, you cannot tackle problems if you're not approaching them systematically. You have to have a good starting position for you to solve an issue like that we face through the impacts of climate change. And part of what our countries really need to do now is to assess how much the impacts are actually affecting our trade flows, our exports, our economies. So we need a really good diagnostic study of the impacts of climate change on our economies. When you have a picture of that, when you have a baseline that clearly shows how much your economy is being impacted by climate change, you will then understand why you actually have to have a budgetary allocation to tackle certain impacts. Because right now, without a picture like that, you are working in a vacuum. You don't understand what you're supposed to do as a government. So the basis upon which good policies and good actions that will safeguard our economies from the impacts of climate change starts with us understanding how the economies are being impacted already. And from that point on, we will know the relevance of us having to say, earmark certain funds and say this here is required for agricultural extension, this year is required for venturing into solar irrigation and introduction of new drought-resistant crops, varieties and animal varieties and things like that. So you need to understand first, where is the threat? How much is it impacting us? How much are we losing now? How much might we lose in the near future if it goes on like this? And what can we do right now? So that's a starting point that many of our African governments need to already engage in. And when you're having this conversation, yeah, it starts to give you the answers to how much money you actually need for starters, because it might be that we do not need as much money as it's portrayed in the global studies. It might be that all you ever needed was to put money in the right places, but not necessarily a lot of money. I would say it's an important thing to do, and every country today in Africa should have this diagnostic study of the economic impact of climate change on the country's economy.
Okay, thank you very much. I wanted to see how technology can be involved in Africa to help issues of climate change, and how do we support issues of women? Women are mostly affected when you talk about issues of land, credit, involved in decision making. How do we support women?
Can I go first? I think in concluding, I would agree with John that our policymakers now need to take climate change to be something which is real and a phenomenon that is actually affecting the national purse. And once the national purse is depleted, it means trouble, because it means they cannot provide for the public services that are so much required. And once it's that way, there's always the gender dimension, as women are the largest consumers of public services. Also, what climate change means is the shrinking tech space. Because once we have our productivity affected, it means definitely productivity goes down, revenues go down, and the governments cannot actually offer public services. And as far as women is concerned, and as far as technology is concerned, we are happy that we are actually living in a space where there is the uprise of e-commerce. But again, that e-commerce needs a lot of infrastructure to actually support that. I know the situation whereby there is some countries in Africa which are actually adopting solar-driven computers. What we are saying is that statistics is that maybe about 36% of women don't actually have the smartphones for them to actually conduct their businesses in the digital space. So in conclusion, I would say that when we talk about empowerment, the first point is actually the grassroots people, and the grassroots people, the majority of them are women, because women in this climate change impact, women are disproportionately affected. And when we talk about the casualties of climate change, we're talking about tourism. And in that tourism space, we see that it employs a lot of women. And so it is in the interest of all the governments to ensure that there is a lot of mitigation on the effects of climate change, and also there is adaptation. So I'm saying that our governments need to actually ensure that our women are actually protected. And how do they do that? By actually developing of strategies that will ensure that whatever means are adopted, they are sustainable, and they are not putting women in a worse off condition. And I like it that the report also spoke of ex-ante and post-ante measures before anything is undertaken. Thank you.
John?
Just to carry on there from where Chengi stopped, I think supporting women cannot be done in a scattered way or in an ad hoc way. I feel like supporting women as the major victims of impacts of climate change should be centralized. So the approach should be that we are working through the national planning system, the national budgeting system, the sectoral planning system, and mainstreaming gender issues as well as climate change issues in all our sectoral plans. So be it the energy plan or the education plan, the health plan, the agriculture plan, before the national budget funds any of these plans, we want to see what are you as a sector planning to do and how do you make sure issues that address the plight of women and maybe youth and other minority groups like the elderly, how are they dealt with in your sectoral plan? Without this incorporated in your plan, you cannot access the national budget. So if this is done for every sector of the economy, it already safeguards, it already brings a centralized way of approaching issues that are impacting women. And this is not only being done for gender, but also for climate change. Because gender and climate change are cross-cutting issues, when you mainstream them into your central budgeting and planning process, then you make them a national issue and you provide for a good way and a good means of them benefiting from the national budget without having to just think about them as ad hoc. So I think that's one of the easiest ways we could think about engaging or supporting women as victims of impacts of climate change.
Well, thank you very much. That was well said. That was wonderful how you brought it out. I know we've come to an end of this discussion. I know it was quite interesting. We learned a lot about how to bring in the service sector, manufacturing sector, you know, involving our different stakeholders, you know, and how even issues of trade come in, and also talking about technology. I think we've come to the end of this podcast. I want to thank Cheng Ndogu and John Kastita Mulema. So I really thank you very much. And also, I want to thank Dave Dispatch for organizing this podcast. I really appreciate it. Thank you. My name is Eugene Jernigan, a trade specialist, and I'm really grateful for moderating this session. Thank you very much.